Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a response of a day for the 12th of Elul. Thank you for joining us. Today we're going to talk about the Tzitz Eliezer's responses to the fourth volume of Nishmat Avraham. Avraham Sofer Avraham is a well-known writer on medical ethics and medical halachic issues in Israel. In Hebrew, he has a book called Nishmat Avraham, so this was the fourth volume of it, where he discusses issues that relate to medicine and halacha. It's on the 12th of Elul of Tavshin Nun Aleph of 1991. It's from Tzitz Eliezer, volume 19, Siman Nun Gimel, and it's a letter that Tzitz Eliezer wrote to Dr. Avraham after he published this volume. In appreciation, he says he'll respond to a few of the issues. So there'll be things like, I think we're going to take three. There's the issue of benching Gomel, of reciting a Birchat Gomel after having gone through childbirth. Then there's going to be the issue of whether or not one can, that's the third issue, whether or not one can take money for somebody else donating kidneys from somebody who's passed away. And then also from the question of what kind of food you give to somebody who needs to eat on Yom Kippur or on a certain occasion, if to eat prohibited food, what kind of food you give them. So the first of those issues is that, remember, Dr. Avraham had written, based on a sefer called Mate Levi. The Mate Levi had said that a woman who gives birth does not need to bench gomel. But Birchat Gomel is the bracha of thanksgiving that we give after certain life-threatening situations, important situations. That it is parallel to what we would have offered a korban todah, what we would have offered a thanksgiving sacrifice for in the Beit HaMikdash. And the Gemara talks about Arba Chayavim Hodot, there are four who have to give thanks, and one of them is somebody who was ill and recovered. So the common custom is that a woman or her husband benches Gomel, says this bracha after she successfully gives birth and is healthy and everything goes well. And this Sefer Mate Levi had written that he thought that wasn't true. She did not need to bench out Gomel. He said it's one way or the other. If you can give birth without danger, there's no need for Hagomel. It's not a danger, and therefore one hasn't recovered from anything dangerous. There's no need to bench to make this bracha or to have given that sacrifice in the Tzemach of the Beit HaMikdash. And if it's necessarily dangerous, he says, it doesn't matter anyway because Hashem commanded us to have children. Hashem created the world to have children so that childbirth is a part of the natural order. And therefore, there should be no reason to bench Hagomel, meaning if Hashem wants it to happen, it shouldn't be thought of as something dangerous that we went through a specific, an unusual danger and have recovered. And therefore, there's no reason to make this bracha. And then he says, and maybe that's why the Shulchan Aruch never mentions that either the woman or her husband should make a bracha of this sort after having given birth. And that's what the Mate Levi had said. Rabbi Dr. Avraham had added that if that's true, then maybe an adult who, for whatever reason, is an adult man who, for whatever reason, has not yet had a milah, has not yet had a circumcision, when he has a circumcision, he maybe also shouldn't have to bench Gomel for the same exact reasons. Either it's not dangerous, even if it was dangerous, it's something that Hashem commanded us to do. And maybe if we perform a mitzvah, we do that which Hashem commanded us to do, there should be no reason, this is the argument, there should be no reason to bench Gomel because Hashem commanded us to do it. And if Hashem commanded us to do it, that takes away the element of danger. Tzitz Eliezer disagrees. He says he thinks the Matelevi need him. They should be pushed aside, meaning he thinks we reject this view. We do not accept this view of halakha, because he says he thinks childbirth is inherently dangerous. It is impossible to have a childbirth that doesn't have some danger to it. And that's why, he says, we have plenty of halachot that deal with a woman who's giving birth, and that we allow various halachic, not just leniencies, but we allow violation of Shabbos for such a woman. We allow her not to fast on Yom Kippur if she's in the process of giving Shabbat. There are all sorts of halakha issues that come up that are only meaningful if it shows that halakha is assuming that there's danger here. So he says, and if the Mate Levi says, but I don't understand, Hashem created the world for us to have children. It's a fasuk in Yeshayahu, lo tov v'ra'al Hashem yitzara. Hashem wants the world to be populated, and Hashem gave us a mitzvah. So he says it's true. The Tzitz Eliezer says it's true. All of that is true, but it doesn't matter. Even though Hashem gave us a mitzvah, and even though Hashem wants the world to be populated, it's still a dangerous thing, and therefore we make agol, meaning he doesn't say this quite exactly, but I think what he means is there are times when Hashem commands us to do something that is somewhat dangerous, and if we recover or if we live through it, that we have to give thanks. And he says more than that, we see the Gemara in Shabbat says that when a woman is giving birth, her sins, whatever they may be, are brought up, meaning it's a time of danger such that if she has serious sins, that can be a time to increase the danger of that moment, and that would be a problem, that would be a danger. And we also have a mission in Bamim Adlikin that many of us say on Friday night, which says, Ashalosh Averot, Nashim Meitot, Bishat Leidatan. There are three sins that will lead to a woman passing away in childbirth, whatever they are. The point is only that Mishnah shows that it was well known and well accepted and well thought of, not well thought of as in good, but well considered, that childbirth brought dangers with it, and that women were in a position of danger. They had to go through it to have their children, but they were in a position of danger, such that when, thank God, they come out of that position of danger, they should make a Birchat HaGomel, they should express their thanks to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and he thinks that that's completely obvious. He doesn't get into this question, but it's come up in other tshuvot that we've seen together as well, of what we consider danger. It came up in the tshuva we saw about Metzitza Bapeh, that's where it was. And Metzitza Bapeh was from the 10th of Elul. But this question of what we consider danger, meaning, let's say, it's never been true that one out of two women passed away in childbirth. It's never been true a majority of women passed away in childbirth. Right? So even when childbirth was extremely dangerous for women, whatever the numbers were, right? So if it was true that you'd have, I think there might have been a time when as many as, it could be wrong, but as many as one in five women didn't make it out of their childbirth years because of things that came up with childbirth. That sounds a little high to me, but in any case, it still means that 80% of people are 80% of women are making it. Whatever the numbers are, my point being that it could be that when we talk about something being dangerous, we mean it sincerely, we think it's dangerous, and we respond to it in that way, even though the absolute numbers might be not as much as you might think, but we think of it as dangerous. So when the Matan Levi says, how could it be that Hashem would put women in danger in order to continue the world when Hashem wants the world continued and Hashem makes it a mitzvah? So that gets into these questions of, well, what do you mean by how many people are we talking about? Right? Let's say it was 1 in 100. So if 1 in 100 women, which is a lot, were to pass away in childbirth, I think that Tzitzel Yezer would say, we still make a Birchat HaGomel because the other 99 came out of danger. Although, theoretically, if 99 out of 100 people have child give birth just fine, you could say, well, it's not that dangerous. 99 out of 100 do well. So that question of what we count as dangerous, what we count as don't, what we count as a worry, and what we don't, I think comes up in a lot of halachic issues, and here would be an example of it. We think of it as dangerous, even though, thank God, and all the board better, not so many women actually have these childbirth complications or have these problems and pass away. Nonetheless, it's a danger such that we thank Hashem for it. Back to the tshuva, the Matan Levi had wanted to prove his point from, or support his point from the fact that Shulchan Aruch doesn't mention it. Tzitzel Yezer says, well, with all due respect, the Matan Levi had forgotten to notice that in the commentary on the tour, let's remember that Rav Yosef Karo wrote three very important works. One was the commentary on the Rambam, the Kesef Mishnah, that's not our topic right now. Another was the tour, which is the predecessor to the Shulchan Aruch, meaning the Tur is the son of the Rosh. In the early to mid-1300s, the Tur writes a book of Halacha where he reorganizes the presentation. It's not the presentation according to the order of the Gemara. It's not the order that the Rambam decided on his own. It's an order that follows, that splits up Jewish law into four sections and the order that we have today. And it was that order and that set of chapters as well that the Shulchan Aruch took for his own book 200 and something years later, 230 years later, let's say. Before he wrote the Shulchan Aruch, the Tur also not only reordered Halacha, the Tur had taken the essence of halacha. He'd taken mostly the halachic decisions. He mentioned a couple occasionally, but he would mention some machlokot, some debates, but very minimally. His point was not to get us into the back and forth of halacha or how we got these halachic decisions, but to mention the basic halacha and perhaps one or two other opinions that were also major opinions on the issue. The Beit Yosef, or Yosef Karo, first wrote a commentary on that called the Beit Yosef, in which he gave much more of the halachic background, much more of the halachic discussion of how those conclusions were reached. And then later, he decided that he wanted to go the Torah one better and made it even more concise and put it into paragraphs, and that became the Shulchan Aruch. So in the Beit Yosef, in the longer commentary, he wrote why it is that some men make the bracha of Hagomel, and why it's not considered a bracha levatala, and he says why it's not considered an unnecessary bracha, because they, after all, didn't go through any danger. Meaning, the assumption of the question is, why wouldn't only the woman be able to make the bracha? And here we see some men make the bracha for their wives. This is in the 1500s. And he says it's to praise Hashem that she was saved and that she came through okay. And so, and he goes through that and has that whole conversation, that whole discussion of that issue. And his worry is that the man didn't go through a miracle, so why can't he make the bracha? But from there you see that he knows of this bracha. He doesn't object to the bracha being made, right? It's not that he has no problem if the woman makes it. His question was only about how could the man can make it for the woman. And once he mentioned it there, the Tzitzel just says, he didn't feel the need to single it out. In the Shulchan Aruch, when he mentions that people have to give a bracha of thanks when they're saved from danger, he felt no need to include this as a specific example. It's just an example of being saved from danger. And then he notes that this is a general rule in the Shulchan Aruch. If the Shulchan Aruch mentions something in the Beit Yosef, and we don't see it in the Shulchan Aruch, we have no reason to think that he changed his mind. It just means that he assumed that we would have known it already from the Beit Yosef. And then he quotes the Torah Chaim as an important Acharon, who also agreed, who said, you know, without a question, that women have to thank God for the miracles that happened to them, including childbirth. Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld also held that the woman should make gomel. He said she can make it anytime after the 7 days after the birth. She doesn't have to wait 30 days, but it was clear to him that she should make it. So from all of that, it's clear that she makes the bracha. And then he adds, and if that's true, then a person who had a brit milah late in life for whatever reason, also, if it turned out to be a dangerous thing, that would be a question of whether medically it's considered dangerous for an adult to have a brit milah. But if there was danger there, he would also have to bench gomel. And this goes in because when danger comes up, there's this idea that any flaws that we have, any problems, any things that we've done wrong come to count against us in times of danger. So this says one of those could be that he didn't get a brit milah until now, and then he adds, yeah, me'ezit tam sheyeh, for whatever reason it was, meaning that Tzitzel Eliezer is implying that even if it was in some sense beyond the person's capabilities to have a brit milah, he was in Russia most of his life, or he never knew he was Jewish, or he never knew that there was a mitzvah for a Jew to have a brit milah, whatever the reason was or would have been, Tzitzel Eliezer is saying that there's some reason for that would be a reason that Hashem, that the mekatrigim, that there would be a person would be prone to more danger. That's a longer topic of when there's divine providence and how it works, and when we're in when our merits save us, and when our demerits, things we've done wrong or we've neglected to do, can hurt us, and all of that is for other times. But that comes up here in this issue, because he says if the person who had the brit milah, even though he's doing a mitzvah, if there was danger involved, when he recovers, notice, he's not saying this person is likely to die. When he recovers, he'll have to thank Hashem for the brit milah. For the brit milah going well, he would still have to give thanks for it, but that part of the reason is that he could have expected that there would be issues. Anyway, that's issue number one that comes up in the tshuva. Second issue, second issue that comes up is in Chelek Orach Chaim, Tav Resh Yud Chet Gimel, the Rabbi Dr. Avraham, in Ishban Avraham, had quoted an Or Sameach. The Or Sameach is a commentary on the Rambam, and the Or Sameach had suggested that the whole halacha that we give Hakal Hakal Tchila. Okay, so if somebody, the issue is this. Let's say somebody is in danger of their lives and they need to have non-kosher food. The only food we have available is non-kosher food, or it's non-kosher food that will for some reason be the food they need to eat that will save them. And we have a choice between two kinds of non-kosher food. So let's say we could give them food that is prohibited with karet. Let's say they could drink blood would help them for whatever reason. Or food that is prohibited by a lav, by an ordinary prohibition, pig. So we're choosing now between feeding them pig or feeding them blood. So the general rule is hakal hakal tchila, that we give them the lesser of the two to the extent that we can. Okay, so the Or Sameach suggested, maybe that's only true for the person who's feeding an ill person. But the patient, him or herself, who's in danger and needs this food, doesn't have to pay attention to it. So why would he think that? He thinks that, he says, because there's another similar halacha. There's a halacha called rodef, which is can be terribly misused, so don't draw conclusions from anything in particular that I'm saying in practical terms, but in general terms, if one person chases another person to kill them, we are allowed to stop the chaser. Not only are we allowed to stop the chaser, but bystanders are allowed to stop the person who is intent on committing murder, if necessary, with lethal force. However, the halacha is that one is only allowed to use one must use the lowest level of force that will get the job done. So if somebody could easily knock the person out, let's say, and instead kills them, that's going to be murder. Even though they were allowed to step in, they were allowed to prevent the death of the victim. Now, if they can argue, I didn't have the ability to be sure that I could knock them out. So let's say the person's far away, and I'm shooting, and I'm not a sharpshooter, and I say I aim for the leg, but I had to make sure the guy got killed, or I had to make sure the guy stopped, and there was no time for two shots, and so I aim for the middle of the body, and the guy got killed. That's one thing. But let's say I'm a military sharpshooter, and I know where I'm going to hit them. And I could hit the guy in the leg, let's say, or in some other place that's going to not kill them, but would certainly stop them. So that's the obligation, that's the responsibility, and doing more becomes capital murder. That's true of somebody, of a bystander. However, the halacha is that with a near death, the person being chased, his life or her life is at danger, they don't have to make any of those calculations. They're just allowed to save their lives. So the Or Sameach said, you see, the difference between the person in danger and the person from the outside. The person from the outside has to use some calculus, has to have the presence of mind to think carefully about how best to do this and how what's the minimum necessary to violate the Torah to do it, but the person being saved doesn't. That's the way the Nishmat Avraham quoted the Or Sameach, and the Tzitzit Eliezer disagrees. So first he notes the Or Sameach himself over there in his discussion of the issue had noted a Mishnah that says that if a had a Braita in Yoma that says that if somebody was bitten by a snake, they still have to take maaser before they eat the, if there's grain there that's not been tithed yet, they would still have to tithe it. So that sounds like even the person is in danger, if possible, without danger to their life, to avoid transgressing the Torah, they have to do so. Sounds like it applies to the person in danger just as much as to anybody else. That the answer, as you found in a Sefer HaMakneh, who wrote the exact opposite. Sefer HaMakneh had said, he thinks that the fact that the Gemara mentions it, the Mishnah mentions it about the bystanders, that they must give a kalat al-kila, he says that's for the exact opposite reason. The person who's in danger himself or herself obviously has to eat a kalakal tequila. Why? Because what would make you think that if you can get by with eating pig, you're allowed to eat blood, which is a more serious prohibition in terms of the punishment the Torah gives it? Why would you ever think of such a thing? So why would you ever think such a thing about the person who's going to feed the ill person, the person on the bystander who's getting involved to save their life? Why would I think that any difference? He says, I might have thought, this is what the Sefer HaMakneh said, that the prohibition of lifnei iver, meaning the Sefer HaMakneh is assuming that when people come to feed somebody else prohibited food to save their lives, what they're violating is only lifnei iver. Lifnei iver is that I lure somebody or I help somebody into violating the Torah. So lifnei iver can't put a stumbling block before them. Sefer HaMakneh says, I might have thought. So once I'm allowed by Torah law to commit lifnei iver, as it were, to not worry about the fact that I'm leading somebody else into sin, into transgression, I might have thought it's all one prohibition. There's a prohibition of, I'm not allowed to lead the Jews to sin, and it doesn't matter what kind of sin that I do, and therefore I might have thought that I can do all this. So the Sefer HaMakneh says, what the Mishnah was telling us is, no, that since the eating of prohibited food is considered chutcha and not chutra, the eating of prohibited food is considered, the Torah was sort of pushed aside. It's still a prohibition of the Torah. It's still violating the Torah. It's just that I'm allowed to push aside the Torah for the purpose of saving this person's life. Then the person feeding that patient is in fact not violating leaf davar. Their leaf davar has been pushed aside for the purpose of saving their lives. If that's true, then the whole calculus of what's more or less prohibited still comes into play, and that's why they say for Ramak they read it, and the Titzel Yezer assumes that that's true. So he says, by the way, this whole discussion of Lifne Iver, of the fact that the Sefer HaMakdeh thinks we might have thought that it all counts the same no matter what I'm alluring or encouraging another person to do, that only works if we assume that Lifne Iver is considered a completely separate prohibition that has no connection to the sin involved. Meaning there's just a blanket idea, I can't lead Jews to sin. If that means I lead a Jew to sin by getting him to, or her, to neglect a rabbinic prohibition, to violate a rabbinic prohibition, or to neglect a rabbinic obligation, or to eat chametz on Pesach, eat leavened bread on Passover, which is the curried prohibition, gets one cut off in the community, it's all the same lifne iver. But as many held, if lifne iver in fact is sort of it's a prohibition in the Torah that attaches itself to each and every other rule of the Torah separately, in other words, and that's what the Baal HaMor in Sanhedrin held. So then, the lifnei iver of a prohibition that has a death penalty to it or a karet to it is more serious than the lifnei iver of a general lav, a general prohibition or a posit or an obligation. And that would mean that the Makna's answer for why the Mishnah speaks about the bystander giving a kal hakal tchila would not work for the Sefer HaMakdeh. So the Titzelizah says, well, but that maybe that's the whole question. That wouldn't work for the Sefer HaMakdeh still, but maybe the whole question was we wouldn't have known without the Mishnah telling us you have to feed a kal tchila, we would not have known whether lifnei iver is a separate prohibition or is tied into the prohibition involved, and therefore you have to do a kal tchila, and that's what's informing us. In fact, lifnei iver is connected to the act that I'm encouraging my fellow Jew to do, and the prohibition, therefore, takes on more severity if the prohibition I'm encouraging this Jew to do is more severe, etc. So he says the Ramban and the Ran and others think of lifnei iver as an avera keshila atzma, as does Rabbi Akiva Eger seem to, and the Tiferet Yisrael has discussed this in a previous volume at length. So for them, you could say like the Sefer HaMakdeh. I'll note that from my perspective, it's not completely obvious to me that even if lifnei iver is a separate prohibition, that it becomes a blanket separate prohibition. Theoretically, it could still be true that you can have lifnei iver of a serious level and lifnei iver of a less serious level within the separate prohibition. I mean, the prohibition is, don't lure other Jews to sin, but when I say that, I could easily mean, and the extent to which you lure them to sin, the seriousness of your having done so will also depend on the seriousness of the thing you lured to them to. But that's not what comes up in the Titzel Yezer. He adds another idea also that he thinks maybe the Mishnah spoke about other people feeding this person to tell us that even if that patient has the ability to feed him or herself, you might think, well, that means that we don't have to do anything. So the answer is no. The other people have to get involved as well because they might be able to do it faster. They might be able to do it better. Even though this person could do it himself or herself, we might be able, that doesn't remove from other people the obligation to get involved in trying to help the sick, the ill person, the ill patient. Finally, the last piece is in the second Chosh Mishpat and Tavchav Lamed Aleph in the Nishmat Avraham. He wonders about, let's say somebody passed away sadly, and they want to transplant the kidney. So there's live kidney plantation, which is from a live donor. You take one kidney out, but there also can be kidney transplantation from a deceased donor, from a donor who's passed away. So the question was, let's suppose there's a relative who's willing to have the kidneys donated but wants to be paid for it. So the Nishmat Avraham had said he thinks that that's a problem because he thinks it's considered nehenem mehamet, or it could be a problem because it's considered getting benefit from a corpse, and we're not allowed to get benefit from corpses from a person who had passed away. Nivul hamet, mistreating a corpse, is an asur min haTorah, is a Torah prohibition, but that would be allowed for pikuach nefesh. So if you think that it's in some way a mistreatment of a corpse to take out the kidneys, that we can get around, that we don't have a problem with because it's saving the life of the person who's going to get the new kidneys. But when it comes to getting benefit from the person who's passed away, that too is prohibited, and most Rishonim and Achronim hold that's prohibited min haTorah, it's a biblical prohibition, and therefore it should be asur. in discussing that, as Rav Ram points out, but there are people who say, well, what about all the people who take care of the person who's passed away for money? So you get, sometimes you have paid pallbearers, you have people who do a tahara, who wash off the body, or who are shomrim, right? The tradition is that after a person has passed away, we don't leave them alone until the burial. So sometimes you'll pay people to sit with the body, and then they'll say tehillim, whatever they'll do, but and they get paid. So the answer to that is that that's something that really the Krovim have to do, the relatives have to do, and so what they're paying is for that other person. They're not, the person's not getting benefit from the person who passed away. The person getting benefit from the relative who is trying to hire a substitute because the relative either doesn't have the time or the ability to do that him or herself. So that would be a heter. That would be a rule of permissibility, but that doesn't apply to the question of transplantation because the relative is not the owner of the body, and the relative is not somebody who should himself have to do the kidney transplantation. We need his agreement. That's a legal issue. You need his or her agreement to the transplantation. But if you're getting reward for that, it would seem to be that you're getting hana, you're getting benefit, and violating a prohibition in the Torah. So Nishman Avraham thinks that's a problem. Therefore, he thinks you can't take money for it. He adds that he thinks that if the money is needed to pay for somebody else's care, another relative's care, then it's going to be allowed because it'll be an issue of pikuach nefesh, like we had in the case, like we had about the whole idea of nivul amet, of the fact that we can take the kidneys out at all, which would seem to be a mistreatment of the body. That was allowed for pikuach nefesh, for saving somebody else's life. So getting money for it, he thinks, would be allowed also if it's going to be saving somebody's life because we have medical treatment that we need. And he says that Rosh Shlomo Zalman Auerbach had agreed to this position. Since this is not so clear, he pauses to say this can only be, in his mind, transplantation that happens after full death of the person, meaning already by then there was some discussion of brain death, which continues to be a thorny halachic topic. There, some people think that brain death is considered death in halacha, and therefore one can take out organs while there's only brain death. Only brain death means there's a medical evaluation. This person has the brain activity has ceased or has largely ceased and is never going to recover, and that's considered a form of death because the person is really, really dead, even though all the other organs of the body are still working, and that eases transplantation greatly. This has been a matter of great dispute. There are many, many important halakhic authorities as well that it doesn't count as death. In 1991, in Tufshin and Aleph, and then in the notes here as he publishes it in the Tzitzili Ezra volume, he notes that on Yud Bet Tishrei of Tufshin Nun Bet, so this is a little later in the year from this thing, they published a letter by Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and Rav Yosef Shalom El Yashiv, both of whom have since passed away, but on the 18th of Menachem Av of Tufshin Nun Aleph of 1991, they wrote about the question of heart transplantation while the heart is still beating, meaning there's what's called brain death, and they think there's no way to permit it, and they think it's not allowed, and they think that it's murder to take a beating heart out of a person. So that's a complicated halakhic question. So there's a pause here to say, let's remember that we're talking about transplantation. The only transplantation that I would be willing to consider is when the donor has in fact completely died, meaning that there's death. And that makes transplantation much, much harder because I think that organs tend to start decaying right away as soon as that kind of death occurs, and it makes transplantation more difficult. Assuming that was possible, Tzitzel finds a way to say that you could get money for it, because it gets to a question of when you take money for a mitzvah, is that considered taking money for the mitzvah or not, or is it considered that you're doing the mitzvah because you're obligated to, and the money just comes on its own? So that's a question that we don't have time to get into, but that's Tzitzel's fundamental position. He thinks that in many cases of mitzvah, if the person is obligated to do something, and therefore they have to do it, and then they get money for it, that money sort of comes on its own, and it's okay. That's one claim, whether or not we accept that. He adds at the end what I think is a very interesting idea. He says, but a way around this whole question is, let's suppose you'd say, we'll only pay the donor, the relative of the donor, we'll pay him only once the kidneys are in the new person and have started functioning and working. Well, if we wait till then by that point, they're no longer the kidneys of a person who passed away, and you're not getting benefit from the person who passed away. They're already new kidneys in a new person, and therefore the benefit that comes does not have to be considered benefit from the person. So if something goes wrong in the transplantation, the person wouldn't get their money, but he thinks that's clearly a way that you could avoid this problem of, this worry of, getting benefit from those who passed away. So that's a response of the day for the 12th of Elul. Titz Eliezer on whether or not a woman has to bench gomel or a man has to bench gomel for his wife, either way. Whether what we do and don't feed a person who is ill, whose life is in danger from an illness. And third, what we can do in terms of taking money for organ, for kidney transplantation. That's Cesar, responsible day, 12th of Elul. Have a great day.